Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Spain gets a no bailout bailout. Markets rise on optimism. Oil ends the worst several weeks, down about 17% in May, and finally gets an uptick. Our guest today, Joseph Brusuelas. He is a senior economist at Bloomberg. We have this, a special webinar series, and lots more to talk about on this edition. The episode is number 267, and it is June 10th, 2012. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Man, oh man, we've had some crazy things happen lately, but here we are another week, and we are trying to make another dollar, right? That's what we do here. We try to learn about the investing world, economics, you know, how to temper your emotions when it comes to investing and get some great insight from some of the best guests that are out there. I want to thank you for sending me some of those great emails and many of you who had also put some very nice comments on iTunes. I really appreciate that. That's one of the places that we can find out exactly what you're thinking. So if you haven't done so already, if you can just go over to iTunes, if you use it, and add a comment, not just a rating, but a comment also. It takes a couple of seconds when you log into your iTunes account, and then we can figure out what you're saying, what you like, what you don't like, and all that. So if you could do that, that'd be awesome. And if you don't know, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'm the leader of this little grouping that we call the Disciplined Investor, and the host of the show. We have a great guest, as I mentioned before, but I wanted to talk about some of the things that happened over the weekend. There's a lot that happened over the weekend, and I got to tell you, just sitting back for a second and thinking about it, it is amazing the amount of things that happen over the weekend, or at least that are announced over the weekend, that are intended to move markets one way or the other, to give a little bit of support or kind of try their best to persuade that things are going to do well. And of course, they do it when markets are not open, so therefore there can't be any reaction. What actually happens, though, is there's a big reaction on Sunday night when futures open, because it's a very thin trading environment. That's what it's all about. And it doesn't really get to, I guess, futures will start really trading with some numbers starting about 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning on Eastern time, because that's when you see, obviously, the opening of the European markets, et cetera. So, right now, there is a real need. It's more than a need. It is something that they have to do, is instill some confidence in these markets, because the money that is flying out of Europe, European banks, is extraordinary. And if you look at that on a chart, it's pretty amazing. We'll probably get to some of that with our guest today. But Spain did get a bailout, which they're calling not a bailout. They're calling it a soft loan now. But what was really disturbing about what happened over the weekend was this, that the first thing that we knew was something was brewing. They talked about it on Thursday and Friday, and the markets kind of anticipated it on Friday as well, that something was going to happen. You saw the euro come in pretty nicely after it was down about almost 1%, finished down about 0.5%, which is a pretty good move. And then what happened was that over the weekend, there was more talk about it. And finally, there was, hey, we're going to have this 100 billion euro bailout of banks through the ESM and the EFSF, and yay, isn't it exciting? And you know what? That was Saturday. Now, since then, which is only a day and a half or so from the time I'm talking here, what happened was a lot of interesting developments happened. Because if you don't know anything about what's going on here, let me give you a little bit of insight just on a cursory level. Basically, the banks in Spain are really in trouble. They can't stand any more shocks. It's just not possible for them to really hold up to anything that may happen, whether it's, for example, more bank runs, whether it is significant moves against them on their equity. And one of the big things that's happening is that, of course, next week, at the end of the week, is the Greek elections. Now, if in fact Greek voters turnout and they vote for the anti-bailout party or something that will resemble that. And Greece does, in fact, exit the euro. One of the biggest problems would be, of course, right now, Spain, because Spain is very vulnerable. The whole euro is vulnerable, but Spain is very vulnerable. Their banking system is very much on the brink. So what they needed to do before there was an election was somehow, whether they actually get it done or not, say that they're going to have a bailout. This is at least my opinion. They first started with saying, oh, money's going to come from the ESM. Well, unfortunately, through the ESM, you can't actually bail out banks. It's only good for sovereigns. It hasn't been ratified, by the way, just a point of reference. And Germany will have to vote on that as well. And we're not so certain that Germany's in favor of all this. I'll get to a little story that Das wrote, a little article that I thought was really fascinating in a moment. But at the same time, they want to go through the EFSF. Now, that one would be interesting, but the problem is it needs 100% approval to do so. So while they are saying that this bailout happened and all the media is all excited about it, and it may end up happening the way that it is designed right now, there's been some subtle changes already since it's been announced. The realization that the ESM is probably not going to be involved, and also the fact that Finland is saying, hey, you know what, if you're going to do this, we want collateral. On top of that, already we're getting, this is the best, you know, you got a bailout with no major conditions. Now, when you saw the bailout of different countries like Ireland or Greece, there's a lot of conditions, austerity measures and certain reporting measures and payment of your various bills, et cetera, would have to be passed through and approved and all this. It would be structural oversight. Well, that didn't happen here. They're basically just saying, here's the money, do what you got to do. Well, wait a minute. Greece and Ireland, they're saying, well, how come they got that? Now, they're trying to renegotiate it. If this deal goes through, what's going to end up happening is it's going to create much more polarity, or it's going to polarize many of the countries inside of Europe because they didn't get this good of a deal. Why is Spain getting such a good deal? Now, my interpretation is Spain's getting a good deal because that would be the easiest way to have it be passed quickly, be approved by Spain. And in fact, it really is just a buffer until next week's elections. This deal may not really ever go through. It really may not. So what I think this is at least initially, it is a giant confidence game, the biggest of all time, that is being used to ensure that there is at least a verbal firewall. There is a verbal force field around Spain in the event that something happens in Greece over the next weekend that is going to create major havoc. And that's why the IMF said there's going to be about a $45 billion requirement to recapitalize the banking system in Spain, but in fact, they wanted $100 billion. $125 billion. How are they going to pay that back? So already, like I said, Ireland is looking to renegotiate their deal, and Greece is, no matter what happens with Greece, no matter what happens with the election, if they stay, if they go, if there's some kind of other variation of the two, they are going to renegotiate their deal, and there's going to be a lot of protesting. This is my version of the situation. There's going to be a lot of protesting. Countries are going to be very much at each other's throat, and Germany is going to be at the center of this all because they're the pivotal country that has to actually, you know, foot the bill for all this. As a matter of fact, in a great piece called The Eurozone Debt Crisis, it's now about Germany, not up to Germany, by Das. He wrote this and sent it to me this week. He said that Germany is financially vulnerable. Irrespective of the course of the event, it faces crippling costs. And he goes on in this great piece to talk about how the problem is that Germany has really enjoyed a major boom over the last number of years that the euro has been in existence, at the expense, in a way, of many of the other countries. But the problem is that Germany needs to keep the euro down, and they need to keep their rates down. Now, if they're going to do euro bonds, which is another discussion, you know, German bonds then go up, and their costs go up. Everything from here on in, when it comes to the whole European situation, is a cost factor to Germany. It's a cost negative to Germany. And because it's such a great manufacturing nation, he goes on to talk about how with a slowdown in the global economy and China, et cetera, they have a really big problem because they're mandating austerity and you're seeing already their exports and their manufacturing slow down dramatically, and they're mandating this, and at the same time, they have to pay for the bills that are being presented. They're the biggest participator in the European bailout slash ESF, whatever the acronym is to describe the bailout of the day. And there really is no way for them to get out of this right now. And some people are even talking about, you know what, forget Greece leaving the euro. Maybe Germany should just leave the euro. But the problem with that is it would really do horrible things to their currency, and it would be a real big problem for them. But their lending rates are going to go up, and really they have no choice of this. And now they're going to be strangled by the countries that they, the very countries they tried to help. Anyway, moving along. We saw that Bernanke came out with a discussion, a testimony in front of Congress, and he talked about how, you know, the economy's muddling along, it's doing okay, and everybody took it as no more QE. We'll see about that. There's been a lot of talk of stimulus from every country around the world, and we actually saw some further easing by China. India held the rates, Canada held the rates, England held the rates, Europe held the rates, which was really interesting. We thought that was going to be at least a little bit of a possible softening, but I think they're holding back and keeping their powder dry, again, till after this Greek election. I think this is a real pivotal issue. I keep fumbling over that word. I won't use it anymore. Friday night, the Chinese came out with some numbers I thought was really interesting, and the CPI was slowing. It was the slowest in, I don't know, 3 or 4 years back to 2008. PPI was also slowing. Manufacturing, import, and export numbers were softer by a good amount. We continue to see their housing prices, you know, move lower. And one of the big issues right now is with China slowing, with the dollar rising, we've seen commodities come off dramatically. I mentioned that oil is off, you know, approximately 20% from its high in about a month, one of the steepest declines in a decade or more. And that's good for consumers because it gives them kind of a instantaneous tax rebate for the wallet. So that's good. But the problem is that, you know, you see when you're seeing oil slow down and inventory levels as they are, you have to wonder, you know, how much speculation, of course, is in there, but how much further we have to go, even if we see that the Iran premium is priced in there. But I will tell you that it does look like oil is somewhat bottoming here, and you may want to start looking at some of the oil names, the oil players, the big, you know, the, not the servicing companies. You saw what happened to Halliburton last week with their guar gum cost for fracking. It just went up dramatically, and they're going to take like a 500 basis points, 5% cut on their margins. That is tremendous. You look at the chart on Halliburton, you wouldn't have bought it anyway because it looks terrible. You got to watch that chart very closely and look at the patterns, which we're going to get into actually in a second. I'll talk to you about this webinar. But when you look at things like, you know, the patterns in oil and the lack of drawdowns, oil could be problematic for a while, but it should be stabilizing somewhere around here, we think. And I would, again, look at the majors as potential buys if we see this market kind of turn around. We did ratchet up our market trend indicator one notch at the end of last week, and that will be reflective on our sites this week. And we actually are very close to probably going up one more notch. It would seem very illogical that with all that's going on that you actually see potential for a strong uptrend, but I think that at least we're going to see the potential for the downtrend softening, definitely some choppiness here. There's a trading range. But, you know, you have a lot of indicators that are showing that there is some benefit in the trend, possibly looking like it's definitely strengthening here. And we'll see, especially with the whole Spanish bailout, what actually plays. I would venture to say that there'll be an initial pop here and then some reality will set in. And then, you know, the question about many of the economics that are coming out this week, because we have a lot of things coming out in the U.S., and, you know, I think the absorption of what happened in China as well is going to be big. But also take a look at gold, because gold has been an interesting play. And with the fact that there's more money coming from governments, you know, a lot of the gold bug is going to be kind of interested in that. One of the things that we like is some of the gold miners, the bigger companies, not the juniors. And as a matter of fact, we put out some alerts on that over the last several weeks on Trigger Point Research on the alerts. Hopefully you're getting your 14-day free trial over there. You can get it at any time. Just go over to Trigger Point Research and or go to the site at the Discipline Investor, and you can get your 14-day free trial. You get the whole deal. You know, you get text messaging and you get emails. Now, some of the companies we like, I'll just name two, is Rangel Resources and Newmont Mining. There's several other ones that are smaller. There's several other ones that have a lot higher volatility ratios and higher beta, if you will. But these two companies are very solid. And Newmont in particular has a nice dividend. But one of the things about Newmont is it's actually, if it could get a little bit higher, it just needs to go just a little bit higher, it's got a fast zone that is approaching. We like these fast zones because you get short squeezes, you get fast movement on the upside or the downside, depending on which way you're you see the zone. But both that and Randgold Resources, GOLD and NEM, are both interesting plays. You know, you have to wait till it actually breaks out before you jump in. And don't just do that. Look at your charts. Look at the resistance zones. And I think we posted those on Trigger Point Research last week or a week and a half ago. And we actually made our target price, which was about an 11% gain on Randgold, in about a week, which was kind of interesting. And then we pulled back the position, and we're looking to possibly get back into that. So take a look at that. Let's see what else. I got lots of little things here. I mentioned the webinar. So, hey, this is what we're doing. I thought that it would be really cool to do these kind of – we're going to do two things at once. We're going to do a GoToMeeting commercial, which we're doing our webinars on. And you could sign up. It's a free webinar. There's a series of four that we're doing over the next month or so. And what you have to do is just go over to Trigger Point Research. I'll put a link on the podcast. There's a place that says, hey, sign up for the webinars that are coming. It's actually triggerpointresearch.com/webinars. And these are classes. We're doing breakout classes. How do you find the sweet spot of when to buy or to short a stock using some really very more modern tools than you would see? We'll compare some of the things like MACD and RSI and all those traditional trend lines. We'll compare that to some of the things that we're doing and the things that we could show you how to use. And I think you'll be really interested. We'll have about a half hour, 45 minutes. We'll do some Q&A. But it's going to be a live webinar. And the next one is Thursday coming up, the 14th. There's one next 2 weeks from there, then 2 weeks from there. But you can sign up. It's limited to the first 100. So if you're interested, you need to do that now. So it's triggerpointresearch.com/webinars. There's a little registration form on the bottom there. Just put your name and email, whatever it is, and you'll be registered for one or more. You can take it. It's kind of a series we're doing. And they're free. And I think you'll find it interesting. I'm leading them. So hopefully I'll provide some interesting points to you there. And we are doing it with GoToMeeting, by the way. And I think I mentioned that before. GoToMeeting is a great advertiser. And we're not doing it because of GoToMeeting, but GoToMeeting is just great. So we're using them. So, you know, summer's here, and that means a lot of us are going to be spending time working and traveling. I'm doing some traveling in a couple of weeks. So, you know what? How do you get everybody together? It's kind of hard. So you get GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. And it lets you host meetings with clients and colleagues. You know, you can do it face-to-face or not. And you could do just an amazing job of having these online meetings. And you'll experience it directly when you actually come to the webinar that we're doing. But you could also get your free 30 days of GoToMeeting with HD Faces by just going to GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST. Then you can download the free app and just do it. They also have this they have some coming up. There's a contest where if you go to the GoToMeeting on Facebook, they're giving away iPads. So all you have to do is go to Facebook and like the GoToMeetings page, and then you can enter to win, and there you go. Great stuff. How about we segue to our guest? Let me get that set up. All right, so we're with Joseph Bersuelas, and he is the senior economist over at Bloomberg LLP, a gentleman who I speak to quite often. He has a great piece that he writes, a lot of pieces he writes. One of them is the part of the Bloomberg Brief that is for subscribers of Bloomberg. And he also puts out a must-see morning video. I think it's called Morning Joe. Joe, how are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me on, Andy.
All right. So listen, there's a lot I want to talk to you about, and a lot of things have happened over the last several weeks. One of the big things that probably you can help me with is a question that's being asked by a lot of people. It seems rather simplistic overall, but it deals with Europe. What is the problem, and why can't we get Eurobonds?
Okay, well, I mean, the essential problem is that the Europeans are stuck in what Americans would understand, at least historically literate and economically literate Americans would understand, is they're stuck between the Articles of Confederation and a real unified fiscal system. They've got 17 different leaders, 17 different parliaments, with 17 different fiscal policies, yet they have one common currency and a common monetary policy, and that's what's caused the problem. The Europeans are stuck between a rock and a hard place. In order to see through the grand European project and the Eurozone project, they're essentially going to have to cede sovereignty from a subnational level to a supranational level, mm-hmm. and that means that, say, Spain and Greece or going to have to accept some oversight of their fiscal operations from Brussels. Now, if they want to preserve their union, if they want to preserve their currency, they're going to have to take a couple of steps. The first thing they're going to have to do is they're going to have to issue a blanket guarantee on all euro-wide deposits in order to prevent a bank run in case the Greeks, A, leave the eurozone, or B, get kicked out of the eurozone, because here's the issue. The eurozone cannot survive indefinitely, mm-hmm. and there will be enhanced risk if there's a run on European bank deposits other than in Greece. The reason why this is a real concern is the situation where you have a run on bank deposits, even healthy banks can collapse. Remember what happened in Lehman after Lehman collapsed, mm-hmm. and we had a run on our own American banks. That's why the FDIC had to double the insurance on basic deposits. Okay, the second thing is that the Germans themselves, although they well understand that the benefits accrued from the eurozone were down to their favor, they have not been able to make a convincing case to the public that they ought to accept the cost of ensuring collective action and providing for the financial instruments and the financial support to move towards a fiscal union in euro bonds. Now, I know that was a roundabout answer, but this is such a deep and complex problem that I had to take some time to go through the different steps.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that everybody agrees that the main issue, first of all, you did say if there's a run on banks. All the data that I look at and through Bloomberg when we try to track the deposits looks like a giant ski slope down when it comes to not only Greece over the last year or so. And some of that data, as you know, is not up to the minute. They don't want us to have up to the minute, probably, but it's not. It's a little bit laggy. But still, even looking at the trend, it's pretty discouraging to look at what's going on. And in Spain is the same situation. And you see almost the reverse. It is the mirror of that over in Germany. Germany's grabbing all the deposits. The problem, as I see it, is, first of all, I agree with a blanket deposit guarantee because people are spooked there. I don't think that they have the same type of kind of keep it in our country concept that we have kind of here. You know, we don't really have the ability to put in banks of other countries. It's just not the way we do things here. But over there, they, you know, do a lot of offshore in Europe. They do a lot of alternative country banking. You know, they can kind of move around, especially now that the euro is the common currency. They can kind of, you know, shop around a little bit more. But more important, the euro bond, doesn't that make Germany weaker and bring up the countries that are, listen, France, you got to scratch your head. Didn't they just reduce the retirement age to 60 this week?
They did. The French did reduce the retirement age to 60. I think there's a couple things. I want to just address, since you brought up the Bloomberg terminal, what we can see. Yes, you can see the European banking deposits with a monthly lag. That's definite, without a doubt. And it's true that in Greece, there's been what we call a bank jog or a slow-motion train wreck. And trained for the last 2 years. Overall banking deposits in Greece are down 40% where they were 2 years ago. Okay, your second question, which I think is really on mark and very interesting, is why would the Germans want to stay in a European Union where they're footing the bill? Well, here's what's interesting is Carmel Asset Management put out a really interesting presentation this week that just nailed this. I'm bringing it to your attention because it really captured the attention of investors globally. You know, if Germany leaves the Eurozone or if the Eurozone breaks up, you're going to have a new Deutschmark. Mm-hmm. The Deutschmark itself will appreciate probably by close to 40 to 50%. And because through the European Central Bank's Target 2 balance system, the German Bundesbank will be on the hook for a lot of the loans that have been made to these other European countries. And, of course, Germany's banks would have to be recapitalized because of the losses that would happen. And, you know, what was interesting about Carmel Asset Management is they made an estimate on the cost. If the euro stays together, the cost to Germany is roughly about $600 billion. The euro breaks apart, the cost to Germany is actually going to be closer to $1.3 trillion. The German people will get a much better deal by staying inside the eurozone than actually either A, permitting it to spin out of control, or B, getting out ahead of the curve and beginning to just kick out other members, or even outright leave. So when you look at the overall cost-benefit structure in terms of policy and what's better off for that country, it may be counterintuitive to even most very sophisticated investors here in the West, but the Germans are better off staying in the system.
And I think actually they, in a very odd way, they would rather maybe meet the demands of Greek when Greek is going to give them the big, you know, the big fingers and say, you know what, we want to stay in the euro, but you know what, we're not paying back this money. The fact of the matter is it's a lot less costly for them to pay off or just to suck up the fact that they gave them $400 billion at this point, that then go through not only the cost of 1.3 or 1.5 trillion euro to, you know, make this happen, but the incredible amount of just upheaval that will happen with markets because of the fact that they have to create a new currency, things have to be remarked, and, you know, then you have all sorts of other problems. The only question I have is there any way at this point, and maybe this is the big problem with Merkel and all that, is there any way at this point to tell, or not even to tell, but to somehow corral the quote-unquote bad countries, you know, the Portugals, Italy's, Spain, and we'll just leave it at Greece right now. Those four. Is there any way to say to hold their feet to the fire to some of the things that they signed off on when coming into the Eurozone?
Well, you're seeing that right now, Andy. I mean, what we have underway is a grand game of policy brinksmanship. And that's why periodically, it seems every other week now, we have these periods of intense financial stress where it looks like, you know, things may begin to get a little bit, as we say in the markets, pear-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Or we have an increase in chances of left-tail risk or systemic risk. It's a game played out in public. It's very not very satisfying to live through. And investors are right to be quite skittish, which is why you've seen a portfolio flow of capital out of Europe in general, even if there are some flows intra-Europe into Germany. You know, I think the thing to remember here is that the Germans have been conferred enormous benefits from the convocation of the euro,
mm-hmm.
and that it's made their own former currency undervalued and has stimulated their exports to these other areas. And it's beyond me that the Germans haven't begun to explain this to their own population. You can say whatever you want about the Germans, but they're an exceptionally bright people,
mm-hmm.
who are articulate and very logical, and I think that they would accept this sort of explanation if the leadership was up for it. But, you know, you and I will sit and talk about economics and finance, but the subtext of this is politics.
Yep,
and the politics
always is.
Of Germany right now is that Daniel Angel and Merkel's ruling coalition simply, for a number of domestic, political, ideological reasons, just will not accept a deeper integration of Europe and an effective ceding away of power from the Bundesbank to a more powerful European central bank, where, from their point of view, the profligate states of Southern Europe will have a much more pronounced say and more power in terms of how overall monetary policy would be set going forward.
Yeah.
But that, to me, is the cost the Germans are going to have to pay in order to preserve their union and their euro. You know, we're at that existential moment now. Are they German or are they European? They have to make that decision, and they have to make it in probably the next 6 months.
You know, when I look at the Bloomberg brief and we talk about some of the different economic conditions, and for example, you know, we look at the Citibank, Citigroup economic surprise index, which is rolling over really hard, and we look at things like the financial situations and look at the financial conditions index and the, you know, Bloomberg and the Bloomberg Plus and all that. One of the things I find really interesting is that just a couple of days ago, I ran all of my baseline levels for European risk factors, you know, 3-month swaps, looking at CDS rates, looking at all the different things that I have. I probably sent you that before in the past. And to be honest with you, compared to September, let's say, last September, things look pretty reasonably okay. Now, I guess a lot of that had to do with the LTRO and the backdoor bailout by the U.S. and all this other stuff. But I'm surprised I'm not seeing a lot of spiking going on from lending on the overnight facility or possibly the OIS 3-month, you know, the swap spreads. Or what's going on with that?
Okay, you hit the nail right on the head. It's the that last $1.3 trillion long-term repo operation that the European Central Bank has conducted. It's just liquefied the front end of the curve. So when you're seeing some of the financial stress that you would normally pick up looking at the LIBOR OIS, the TED spread, the 3-month euro swaps, euro basis swaps, it's just not there in the data, which is why looking at the Bloomberg Proprietary Financial Conditions Index, both for the U.S. and the EU, which is the only daily tracking index of financial stress, is absolutely critical. It's literally, when I fire up my Bloomberg terminal, it's the first thing I go to, even before my email, when I get in here before, 6 a.m., to see what's going on early in the European session. And in terms of the connections between what's going on in Europe and financial conditions into the real economy, the Citi Economic Surprise Index is quite good. And it rolled over earlier this year, and it hasn't stopped. And by the way, for everybody out there, Bloomberg's got its own Economic Surprise Index that will be published, and it's a proprietary thing. You'll only get it on Bloomberg, but look for it, and you will see it in the Bloomberg Bloomberg Economic Brief very soon.
Yeah, well, most people that are listening don't have Bloombergs, but I do.
They got to get them.
But I do republish a lot of that stuff, of course, with appropriate sourcing. And as a matter of fact, I will put the chart of that. Now, I have a question about that. You say you look at it, and that's a daily piece, though. It's not an intraday mover, is it? Oh, I guess it is an intraday mover because a lot of the pieces are intraday calculations, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so okay.
And we're very proud of this, and we've talked to the Fed about this, and we've had a number of the different regional Feds model their financial stress index after what we've done here. And again, it's the only daily index.
And it's almost like a leading index because you do include
how popular it is.
You include the stock market.
On the function inside the elite 315,000 users that we have right now in the global marketplace.
So one of the things you do, I know, is it's on the verge of a leading index.
It is. In many cases, on the system itself, you can compare it to the S&P 500. You can compare it to all sorts of real economic indicators. And many times it does lead, changes in direction.
Right.
In terms of the overall economy.
Yeah. All right. Now, something that's always, I probably asked this 100 times and I'll ask it 100 times again. This whole inventory thing just makes my head spin because there's two components. We see wholesale and business inventories come out. And there's obviously the more important. That's just looking at, P/E ratio, for example, of a stock. It doesn't tell you anything itself. But when you look at it in a stock with P/E to growth, it's the same thing as looking at inventory to sales ratio. Inventory to sales ratios have been kind of stuck, not moving a lot, depending on which one you look at. But when we see that inventories are on the rise, shows me two things, right? It shows me, number one, okay, that may be good for manufacturing because, somebody's got to make the goods and got to build the inventories. On the other hand, I say, that means maybe possibly there's not a lot of sales going on. People aren't buying things, so inventories are climbing. And then I say, on the other hand, when you see a good inventory number and better than expected, that's going to go into GDP as a plus. But it seems to me to be one of those numbers that is, it's all in the eyes of the beholder in a way. Do you think? You there?
Hello, I lost you. You there?
I was giving you a whole rant on wholesale inventories.
Your cell phone's going down. I'm sorry. Let me answer your question. I did hear 98% of what you were saying.
Okay,
so on inventories itself, we saw the inventory data for April be released today. So the overall inventories increased. Now, generally, when you've got an overall economy slowing and you see inventories accelerating, that's not a good thing. So I wouldn't take much inspiration from that increase in that inventories. It's mixed data, though. For example, we saw an acceleration of inventory buildup in automotives at a time when automotive sales have slowed from an annual pace of 15 million in February to 13.5 million, which is the last data point now for May. So that's not good, and that does suggest that inventories will be a headwind in terms of growth in the current quarter. Now, as an economist, I go straight to that durable, non-durable goods inventories number because that's the one in today's wholesale inventories report that feeds in the calculation of GDP. That actually contracted by 0.1%, the second straight month occurred in contraction, 0.6%. So you can see overall it's slowing, in terms of how GDP is calculated, but there does remain a risk based on the very, very strong inventory build we saw in the period of November through February. Mm. And given the slight behavioral shift in terms of demand for overall durable goods, that, inventories are going to be a problem here in this quarter. You know, the Bloomberg consensus forecast expects 2.1% growth in the current quarter, but given the trend in the data, we'll do well to get to the current 1.9% that's on the books right now in terms of growth in the first quarter, although that's tracking now with the last trickle of data coming in around 1.8%.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised to see it slip to 1.7% before it's all said and done.
Mm. All right, in closing, I just want to mention that, you know, obviously China is a big question right now, and a lot of their exports, they have the biggest trading partners, Europe, and a big concern about the slowdown there, and then the move over, questioning how you can actually trust China data, but okay, let's just kind of go with it and deal with it. But what I find interesting is that, you know, we come out with the cash for clunkers, we come out, which is a third round of this, I believe, in the last 4 years or so. You have and that's the last thing we need is more cars in China. Then we have the cash for washing machines, I believe, or durables that came out. I'm thinking these have moderate effects, and cash for chopsticks. What do you think?
I don't know the Chinese domestic consumption market at that level.
It's large. Oh no, this is large.
This is part and parcel of what you would expect to see with centrally planned demand-driven economies. That they're going to take what measures they can to spur domestic consumption in an effort to replace the losses in terms of export demand that China's facing with respect to Europe. You know, Europe absorbs roughly 20% of Chinese exports. So they're trying to offset or effectively replace the revenues and growth that they're going to they would normally see from Europe with domestic sources. For them, fortunately, they've got healthy cash surpluses, and they can afford to cut rates and even engage in another round of fiscal stimulus.
Yeah.
They're in a much better situation, and they've got a strong current account balance. And for now, it works. But over the longer term, the Chinese will run into some very difficult structural impediments given the way their economy is.
Yeah, just to let you know.
And then, of course, there are the very visible problems in the Chinese housing sector.
Yeah.
And the ghost towns in sort of effectively middle West China, where they've built these towns up to support 1 million people, yet 30,000 people live in them. And they run into the classic problem that many emerging markets do, which is one of overcapacity. Eventually, the contraction comes, and it will come for China, and that will be very difficult. The degree to which it will impact us will be just how hard the landing is. And I want to put the clear, China's not going to have soft landing. When you have those sort of booms, you don't have soft landings. You have hard landings. It's just a degree of how hard will it be, and will the steps the Chinese government put into place be effective to cushion that hard landing?
Yeah, let me give you some quick stats here. 45 billion pairs of disposable chopsticks are produced annually in China. It adds up to about 1.6 million cubic meters of timber, or 25 million fully grown trees every year. In 2006, the People's Republic of China imposed a 5% tax on disposable chopsticks to reduce waste on natural resources by overconsumption. Just thought I'd let you know. No.
Those are some statistics. I hadn't heard of those before. Those are very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, what they do is they actually will do, you know, if they pull the surplus tax, or for that matter, make people actually utilize permanent chopsticks, we can actually, obviously, the timber industry wouldn't be too happy, but at the same time, maybe they can do some kind of a recycling plan or something with them, and they can create more housing with it. I don't know, something like that. But anyway, listen, I want to thank you. Lots of great information here. One of the things I want to mention is that if you are interested in economics, or even if you're not interested in economics, and you want to know right from where it comes from and the good stuff, there is an entire series, a daily morning update. Early in the morning, Joe puts out the morning economic briefing, if you will, 5-10 minutes maybe. It's available. Why don't you tell them how to get to the actual spot to watch this?
Okay, well, you can go to the BloombergBrief.com to see samples of the many different briefs we put out, And then you can go to our YouTube page, Bloomberg Brief. Just search on YouTube, and you can subscribe and get the Morning Cup of Joe each day just at 7:30 a.m.
Yeah, that's great stuff. I really appreciate it. And next time, I know I missed you when I was in New York last time. I was there with Richard, and I was there with Kevin and all that. But next time I'm in there, we'll definitely have an opportunity to spend some time together.
I hope to see you. We'll see you later.
All right. Bye. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Yeah, I do encourage you to go check out his various morning videos that he puts out, as well as the Bloomberg Brief. Let's kind of pick up a little bit where we left off just for a minute. I want to kind of give you a quick updates on some of the things that are going on. I mentioned earlier that, of course, we know that the Spanish bailout, non-bailout happened, and we're going to have to muddle through the next number of days with a lot of hemming and hawing from different parties and figuring out whether or not, whether or not there's really going to be this number, or it was just a, kind of a smokescreen just to make sure that things will be okay and there'll be a lot of confidence. Already we're seeing that gold is up, in the early hours of the opening on Sunday, and we're seeing that the euro is up about 1%, and futures are doing very nicely. Don't forget, you had a record number of short exposed traders and speculators on the euro. So any kind of move that would be taken even slightly positive, if not very positive, would really do a marvelous job at squeezing those shorts out, especially the weakest holders. A lot of analysts have been looking for about a 121, 119 on the low side of the euro, which still could come, but you're going to see this incredible volatility. And any time that you see that the euro is down or the euro is up, it makes a very significant impact on our markets because the dollar obviously has been climbing. Now, the dollar was up about, 7% over the last month or so, so there's a lot of potential take back that can happen here. And don't forget, everyone's favorite currency to short, aside from the euro, is the dollar, knowing that Bernanke and his company are behind the whole idea of possible further stimulus and monetary easing, et cetera. And with that, you have to realize that a lot of the players that went short the euro because they thought that this was really going to be the end game, which, again, we're not done here yet, but we haven't seen any real movement. In fact, I would dare say that this whole $125 billion bailout of the banks is only going to saddle Germany with more money, with more problems, but also more importantly, it increases the actual debt load of Spain. Spain was having a hard enough time paying their current debt load. Now all of a sudden they have another $125 billion on their balance sheet because they're responsible for this. Again, we'll see how that plays out and how traders really see this over the next several days and into next week. But after next week, we could have some decently clear sailing, hopefully, and possibly even change of market trend. We'll have to see. There's been some very interesting developments when it comes to individual stocks, and if you are, in fact, investing in that versus, let's say, ETFs or mutual funds, I mean, there's been some really rocky roads. You look at what happened last week with companies like Titan Industries, which we were short, which was down 22%. You look at Tempur-Pedic. You know me, I've been hemming and hawing over the mattress companies for a long time. We were not short, unfortunately, but it was down like 50% one day on very soft guidance, and it really pulled down the other mattress companies. Mattress Firm Holdings also came out with earnings that were okay, but yet it was dragged down, and Select Comfort also was dragged down. And what you're finding is a very strange kind of the consumer is still very resilient, no matter what you want to say. The service index on the ISM was up nicely. You saw that was a couple weeks back. So confidence was up pretty nicely recently. And that's even in the face of a poor jobs number. But yet, at the same time, remember something, and I think this is probably the most important lesson that we could all learn, is that the economics, sentiment, the trend, what we hear in the news is not always necessarily what happens to an individual stock. So you could have the markets coming down or markets going up, and an individual stock could be going the opposite direction or nowhere at all. You could have a great news item that you would think should move a stock, like an earnings number, but it just doesn't. On the other hand, you could see something where a company comes out with just a statement that they're looking for strategic alternatives, and the stock is up 25%. So, remember something, that one of the big parts of the art of this whole idea of investing is not only the idea of looking at fundamentals, it's not only looking at technicals, it's kind of mashing it up together. You need to have solid companies, or reasonably solid companies, and you need to have the charts, the technical direction that is playing in the direction that you want to trade. Because you could have the best stock in the world. You think it is just, this is just, man, look at the balance sheet, look at the cash flow statement, look at the PE to growth, look at all these wonderful things about this stock. Oh, man, management is fantastic. And Meanwhile, the stock is dropping like a rock. And you're either going to do one of two things. You're going to hold on to your fundamental outlook and your analysis. So you're going to realize maybe there's something out there that the masses are selling for. And what's more important? As my good friend Brian Shannon says, you know, it's only price that pays. So at the end of the day, you could be right about your fundamentals, but very wrong about the technicals. So you have to have both of those playing. And actually, you could be very wrong on the fundamentals. You could have a company you think is a piece of junk, but the company's just skyrocketing. A lot of things happen. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of different variations of the same scenario. But that's why you want to look at charts as the final and kind of the place to where you initiate a trade and you find support and where you want to hold on to, where you want to add on to, where you want to maybe look for a bounce play, et cetera. So again, that just back to the webinars, we're going to be talking a bit about that and showing you some examples of that and kind of take you through that. So if you're advanced or even intermediate or beginner, it's all for you. Check out the webinars at triggerpointresearch.com/webinars, or just go to the website. Our website will have some information there for you. Okay, so let's kind of finish up a couple of other points here. Apple's WWDC is coming next week, and there's a lot of speculation of what is going to be announced. I mean, they're talking about possibly a refresh of the MacBook line, the MacBook Pro, the iMacs. Some people are talking about the iPanel, the TV. They're talking about a variety of different little nuances, maybe hinting about an iPhone 5. But right now, I think that, I don't know, I would be interested in looking at a MacBook with a Retina screen, with the new, I believe, is it Sandy Bridge? Is that the processor? There's a new processor. Also, Mountain Lion. I'm going to see what happens there. And I got to tell you something. I'd like to hear their overall tone on the computer industry in terms of actual PCs, you know, computers and desktops, because what we saw out of HP, what we saw out of Dell was not encouraging. And really, that's going to all come down to the phone and the tablet market. So who knows what they're going to do for the tablet market. There's going to be something coming out there, and they're going to have some additions or some further interaction. But I will tell you that there is really a major, major move towards tablets by companies. And the number one company in that area is Apple. So Apple is actually getting towards that number, I think it was 582, which it closed, 581 it closed on Friday. But 582 and a half or so is a breakout level, or at least an initial breakout level with some good support underneath it. So Apple could be on its way over 600 again if this market catches a little bit of wind. And, of course, with the WWDC coming, if there's any significant announcements or at least some kind of a hinting. So we'll be watching that. You can go to just look up WWDC on the internet, and you'll find plenty of access. Apple has an app for it, so that should be interesting. We also have a couple of biotech conferences coming up this week, and this should be moving the biotech companies, a couple that we like. One of them we like is United Therapeutics. That's an interesting play. We got a couple other ones in there, but it's not exactly in the biotech. Got to be careful with those because they could move for all sorts of crazy reasons. And then the other thing that I'll mention to you in closing is that it is the summertime. Volumes are a little bit lighter. As a matter of fact, volumes were light all last week. You have to be careful about that because things will move around. Don't get spooked out. Leave your emotions at the door. And when you want to find some good quality stocks, you know, that are timely to buy, or ETFs, whatever it may be, don't always think that, you know, that the end is near when it comes to a stock moving down. There are some very good places when you can buy a stock on a bounce. Now you got to be careful of those, because if the trend has been down and you don't want to just grab a quick one day or then just get slammed the next, right? But consider, you know, not falling in love with a stock. You know, just because you like Green Mountain doesn't mean you have to. Have to have the stock, or maybe probably the more pertinent example would be Facebook, right? You know, Facebook, if you fell in love with it, you loved it, but the stock is just not playing. So we'll see what happens with that. And the other thing is that we'll watch the VIX here under 20. That's kind of a demarcation point, 19 or so. It was 25 last week, but dropped down very nicely towards the end of the week, where the anticipation for this came out of, you know, something coming out in Spain. So anyway, we're going to wrap it up, a little bit of an early day here. I really do encourage you. I said it like six times. I'm going to say it again. I really want to see you at the webinars. You've been listening to me for a long time. I want to see you there. They're free, but I want to give you some of this access to some of the things we're doing with the these various things. The first one's going to be a little bit more basic, talking about breakout points, breaking down, breaking up. We're going to be talking about how to find those sweet spots, you know, what to be looking for, the difference between old and modern indicators, some tools that you can use depending on the platforms that you use, and we'll have some questions and answers. And take some things and show you some real stocks and some ways in which you can actually trade and give you something to think about. If you pick up one thing, it's, you know, it's going to be great. So check it out over there at triggerpointresearch.com/webinars. And of course, if you're just not interested in managing your own money and you're not interested in doing it yourself, well, that's what we do here. We use some of the tools from Trigger Point Research and amongst others. Just go to disciplinedinvestor.com. We'll give you a quick walkthrough of what the management is like. I don't think you've seen quite as a customer-friendly service like this or an investor-friendly, because we're actually showing you what we're doing all the time. So you can follow along how we're trading, what we're doing, and we write it up on a regular basis on a client private blog. We have, who do we have coming up? We have an economics expert from Europe coming up next week. I know Frank Curzio will be coming back soon. Josh Brown, we talked to today, he'll be coming at the end of the summer, the reform broker. Das, I have to get back on soon. We're going to talk to him. Tom McClellan is another name that we have lined up. I know that he's going to be coming on soon and talking with him. And a bunch of other really good ones. Don't forget to listen to DH Unplugged as well. Have a great weekend. I hope you enjoyed the part of the tennis match that you could see, and go Heat. Great game. I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.